Adapting to climate change and sea level rise here on the First Coast. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, meet some of the people working every day to help communities across the First Coast adapt to climate change and sea level rise. In the new Adapt podcast and special edition online today at adaptflorida.org. What are your questions about climate change in Northeast Florida? Have you made any changes in your life to prepare for it or in response to it? We want to hear from you now at 549-2937, or you can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweet me at Jessica Pub Radio, or leave a comment on this post today on Facebook on the WJCT First Coast Connect Facebook page. Then later, WJCT sports analyst Cole Pepper reacts to the untimely loss of basketball legend Kobe Bryant. But first, Adapt is WJCT's online magazine covering how this area is adapting to sea level rise and the other effects of climate change. And today we are very excited to launch a brand new special edition of Adapt, along with the first ever Adapt podcast, both at adaptflorida.org. One of the people you'll meet in the podcast and at WJCT at adaptflorida.org is Julia Neshawat, the first ever Chief Resilience Officer of the state of Florida. In her first one-on-one sit-down interview with a reporter in Florida since she was appointed last year, she spoke with our very own Brendan Rivers. Let's take a listen to Brendan and Julia Neshawat's conversation.
Speaking of local Chief Resilience Officers, I'm pretty sure Jacksonville is the only major city in the state that doesn't have one. I mean, even smaller communities are getting them now. St. Augustine just appointed their first Chief Resilience Officer. And Jacksonville, I mean, Jacksonville's not getting hit as hard as, say, Miami is, but we do have more shoreline than any other community in Florida. Absolutely. Because of the St. Johns River. So are you or would you encourage leaders to create this position or create some office to really focus on these issues?
I think it would be helpful, but at the same time, you know, I would defer to the local officials on what they think would be best within their county or city. But I will say, speaking from having traveled throughout the state, I've noticed, you know, some cities are more active than others. But I'd like to go back to the part about having the regional planning councils. I think that more than anything has been tremendous, because you're having multiple cities come together, which is, I think, much more powerful than just doing it alone. I think Jacksonville certainly is just as vulnerable, whether it's because of, you know, the next hurricane, rising sea levels, flooding issues. And so I hope to be visiting out there sometime soon and working with the team that's out there.
And yeah, I would love to talk more about regional efforts, but one more question. Mm-hmm. About Jacksonville's specifically efforts. I believe we're also the only major city that doesn't have a climate action plan. So is that something that you're encouraging all these local municipalities to start developing?
I think it's important that, yeah, every city has a community action plan, a resiliency plan, whether it's to prepare for the next hurricane or to look at the next assessments when it comes to rising sea levels. That's just important in any situation, and not just the cities, but also even local businesses all should have some sort of community action and resiliency plan.
So in our area, the Northeast Florida Regional Council, which I know you're familiar with,
yes,
has been leading the resiliency effort for years. But the Jacksonville City Council almost decided to pull out of it this year. And the council is expected to reconsider it again when budget talks pick back up. So how important are regional efforts like this when it comes to resiliency?
I will say very important. Again, it's just too expensive to go at it alone. And there's a lot of best practices out there. So having that regional collaborative effort is going to certainly be instrumental, especially for that area.
That's Julia Neshawat again, speaking with our very own Brendan Rivers in the Adapt podcast. And Brendan joins us now for a closer look. Welcome, Brendan.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Also, Adam Rosenblatt, an assistant professor of biology at the University of North Florida, and one of the other people that we'll meet in the podcast. Good morning, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
And another podcast guest, Lauren Watkins, is in the studio. She teaches people how to communicate about climate change as the director of behavior change strategies with the consulting firm Impact by Design. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone is Jim Bruggers. He's a reporter with Inside Climate News. Good morning, Jim.
Yeah, good morning from Louisville.
Good morning from Louisville. Good morning. And Join us with your questions about climate change and adaptation in Northeast Florida. Call us now, 549-2937. Brendan, so as you were talking with these six people you profiled in the podcast and this special edition of ADAPT, what were some of the common themes that you heard coming up over and over again?
I mean, there are a lot. That's one of the surprising things about working on a project like this is you have all these different people working in different spheres, but they tend to bring up a lot of the same things. And one of the most interesting things to me, and it's cool to bring this up because the two people where this really showed up are in the room with me right now. So when I asked Adam to give me the grade school explanation of climate change, he used this blanket metaphor, which is what Lauren told me is the most effective way to describe climate change. So I've been curious, Adam, why did you use that metaphor?
I, as a scientist in the past, I've definitely defaulted to some more complex explanations of things, right? And you see people's eyes glaze over. You're talking about, you know, atmospheric chemistry and physics and all that stuff. But if you can just reframe things in a, you know, a way that people can really relate to from, you know, just their daily experience, I feel like that has a bigger impact.
And what is the blanket metaphor?
The blanket metaphor is just that, you know, the Earth is warmer than it would be otherwise because we have this blanket of atmosphere over the planet. And, you know, what we're doing with greenhouse gas emissions is we are increasing the thickness of that blanket, right? And that's kind of the easiest and quickest way to explain what's going on.
Right. So Brendan, besides the blanket metaphor coming up over again, were there some other things that you heard in common among these conversations?
Yeah. So I keep hearing over and over again from scientists, from elected officials, from people working in advocacy, the most important thing you can do as an individual to help fight climate change is talk about it. Mm. And so my conversation with Lauren was great because she really lays out some of the best tools to do that effectively and to get somewhere.
So Lauren, before you were a guest on the ADAPT podcast, you came here to WJCT and you gave us one of your workshops on communicating about climate change. And I think it is safe to say that your presentation was really what spurred the idea for this whole series. And especially this concept that when you're talking about these issues, they can be kind of scary and people want to shut down, but you need to leave them with some sort of hope at the end of that conversation. So I'm wondering what else do you hope that people take away from your conversation with Brendan when they're listening to this?
Sure. Yeah. So as you mentioned, talking about climate change can be pretty scary. And I was pretty terrified before I went through training with the National Network for Ocean and Climate Change Interpretation. And they actually have a website, climateinterpreter.org, where you can learn some skills on how to talk about climate change in a less scary or polarizing way that's hopeful. And some of the things I really want people to know is that there are support networks out there on how to do that, so you don't end up in an argument about politics, that you're just sticking with the facts and coming at the conversation from an angle about things that people already value, like the economy or business or their family, rather than just, you know, like Adam said, talking about the science of it. Mm-hmm. And this is what scientists say, you know, because that doesn't land with everybody. And I think that Nokia can be a good resource for that.
One line really stuck out to me from your interview where you said, not everybody cares about a polar bear in the Arctic. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, most people, I would think, like polar bears to some degree, and that we can mostly agree on that. But not everybody is motivated to change their behavior or vote a certain way because of images of polar bears hanging on to, you know, the last pieces of ice in the Arctic, as I mentioned in my interview. So it's better to come at it, try to understand where they're coming from with their disagreement with you or their passion about climate change not being human caused, things like that, and help have that conversation framed from that point of view. Mm-hmm. is better, because as shocking as it is, not everybody loves polar bears and can get on a climate change motivation from that angle.
Yeah. And your episode really kind of plays as a toolkit, as sort of a step-by-step guide of how to have a productive conversation. So I think that'll be helpful for people to listen to.
Awesome.
And Adam, and as we hear in your episode, you are a professor at UNF. You're studying the effects of climate change on animals firsthand. And at the same time, you're going out and trying to get elected officials to change policies. So why did you get into advocacy on top of teaching?
It was really simple, actually. I've been, you know, doing research and teaching about climate change for about, I don't know, 15 years or so. And then I moved to Jacksonville, took this job at UNF, and also my daughter was born around the same time, my first child. And, you know, when I thought about my work, I said, you know, if I'm going to really be able to talk to my daughter when she's 20, 30 years old about what we were doing at this time when we knew all this information, and, you know, there was the opportunity to act on this issue, I want to be able to tell her that I did everything I could, right? I have to, you know, actually put some boots on the ground and put some real effort into trying to get the local community to realize this is an issue and take some action. Because if I don't do that, like with somebody like me or like Lauren, who has a ton of knowledge about this, right? Like it's inherent on us to take the first step and really, really try to push the conversation forward.
And as you told Brendan, you and several other scientists locally wrote this letter to local officials asking them to take certain steps. How has that evolved since you wrote the letter? Have you gotten responses from City Hall? Have you felt like steps are being taken?
There's been some, both positive steps and, you know, neutral steps, I guess. We'd never heard from Mayor Curry, which was a little bit disappointing. But what's happened since the last time I spoke to you all was that the Resiliency Committee at the, you know, City Council is starting up actually today.
Right.
Brendan will be there. I hope to be there as well. I think it starts at 2 p.m. at City Hall. If anybody's interested in attending that meeting, I believe it's an open meeting to the public. Mm-hmm. City Council member Matt Carlucci is, you know, headlining that, and it's going to be the start of hopefully a much broader and longer conversation that will spur the city into really concrete action.
So is that something that it's safe to say you and others in the scientific community will be watching closely to see what happens in that committee?
Yes, we'll be very closely watching that, and we'll also be participating in that. They're going to bring myself in. They're going to bring in some other scientists from JU, UNF to speak about the threats to Jacksonville and why this is, you know, an issue that we need to tackle immediately.
All right. And we'll get to some of your calls in just a moment. But first, Jim, thanks for being on the phone. You met Brendan at an environmental reporting workshop that you and your colleagues at Inside Climate News hosted in Nashville. Now your nonprofit news organization is featuring this ADAPT podcast in a collaborative project you're calling Caught Off Guard, The Southeast Struggles with Climate Change. So Jim, why do you think these local stories are worth highlighting on this national or regional level?
And thanks again for having me as part of your show today. So this Caught Off Guard is a product of 9 newsrooms in 7 states, from Florida to West Virginia. And, you know, the Southeast region is among the most vulnerable regions of the country to climate change, from sea level rise to stronger hurricanes to, you know, flooding from changing weather patterns and heat. And we're also, our region also is a major contributor to global warming, you know, in pretty substantial ways. And we're also a region where the politics is among the more resistant in some corners to doing something about it. And we actually found, you know, in some examples where state officials are even reluctant, or local officials are even reluctant to use the terms. So, I think it's important to bring awareness, and this is all part of it. And we hope that by collaborating this way, that we'll be, you know, we'll be actually making, you know, national awareness to these local issues.
And can you tell us about any of the other findings that are in this project alongside Brendan's from around the Southeast?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the general theme, and it came up organically from each reporter asking questions in their local community. But the general theme from these stories is that these journalists found communities that were struggling with funding or with a lack of political will, and also with the need for technological breakthroughs to meet climate change head on. And they do vary. I mean, in Savannah, Georgia, for example, no one is routinely counting greenhouse gas emissions from the nation's 4th largest seaport there. And the reason the reporter was told is because they don't have to. You know, in low-lying Charleston, South Carolina, you know, they're looking at spending something like $2 billion to gird themselves against the impacts of climate change, but they're doing very little to cut its emissions, even though they have stated some goals. And so, you know, reporters there were pressing their mayor on, you know, shouldn't we also work on the mitigation side in addition to adaptation? And, you know, I could go on. I'll just conclude with one other example from South Carolina, where they've been, you know, more than 30 people have died in four hurricanes and a major flood in the last 5 years. And, you know, the reporter there asked the governor's office, why don't we have a comprehensive climate change plan? And the answer was, well, private industry is more than capable of adapting to a 21st century economy without imposing more regulations. So, you know, it was just our effort to try to ask questions of people who were in authority about why they are or are not doing something related to climate change.
And Jim, where can people see this collection of stories from Inside Climate News?
Well, we assembled a landing page at Inside Climate News website, which is insideclimatenews.org. And so people can go there and they can read an overview story that I did. And there's links to Brandon's work as well as the eight other newsrooms. And that's, you know, that's a good place to do it. And also just pay attention to Twitter today and maybe later in the week for the hashtag caught off guard, because we're hoping to have a conversation take place on Twitter and social media under that hashtag.
Okay, thank you. That's Jim Bruggers at Inside Climate News. Appreciate you calling in. And going to the phones here in Jacksonville, John in downtown Jax, you're on the air. John, good morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call, and I appreciate announcing, you know, the 2 o'clock meeting that will be taking place later on today at City Hall. And just reading from the council calendar, setting the scene of climate change and sea level rise session, you know, in the Linwood Roberts room. But what I also want your panel to comment on, if they haven't already, and that is what's taking place with our Charter Revision Commission. You know, right now, you know, that this is our charter, and the proposal is to create a new urban services district authority, if you will, which they are still debating on the boundaries of this authority and the taxing of this, where the funding will come from that. And I was just wondering if any of your panel is participating in this legislative process that's taking place right now.
Thanks for that question. Adam Rosenblatt, is that something that you're following?
This is the first I'm hearing of this endeavor. So, to be honest, I know nothing about it. I don't know if there's any details anybody else can provide.
As for the meeting that's happening today, though, with this Resilience Committee, and again, Brendan will be covering it. You can follow him at Brendan Rivers on Twitter for updates later today. How big of a deal is that for the city?
It's a great first step because again, I'm relatively new to Jacksonville. I've only been here for about 2.5 years, but my understanding is that the city hasn't really had sort of formal conversations about resiliency and adaptation, at least for, I don't know, a number of years. I know there's been sort of some piecemeal things along the beaches when it comes to, you know, adding more sand and those kinds of efforts. But this seems like it's the first sort of comprehensive look at what the city's doing, what can they do better, and what should we be doing in the future. And so it's hopefully it's just the start of a much broader conversation.
Great. And Dr. Stanley calling from Middleburg. Good morning. You're on the air with First Coast Connect.
Good morning. I just like to compliment the panel on the important work that they're doing. I'm a teacher educator, and I wanted your thoughts on how we can make children more resilient about these issues, because they're causing a lot of anxiety. What would you recommend for parents in teaching children about this issue?
Thank you for that question. And Lauren, I think you're qualified to answer that one.
Sure, I'll take a stab at it. I think for me, the most important thing would be to help them understand that there is hope. And when you're talking about climate change with children or with parents or having that conversation with their children. There are a lot of examples that you can find online of cities and people and kids their age, you know, marching or putting together community level solutions and initiatives. So to me, that's really hopeful. There are tons of examples out there, and you could talk to the children about how there are people out there working on it really hard. And even though maybe they can't make decisions about CO2, what kind of car they're going to drive yet, but they can be active online and they can participate in marches. They can talk to their teachers. I've seen and worked with some schools that the kids have actually spearheaded initiatives to curb their school's CO2 emissions at their school community level. So there are a lot of examples out there, and those can provide kids, I think, with a lot of hope that they don't have to wait to their adults to help do something.
And I would add to that, I mean, you know, just look to, you know, Greta Thunberg, right? I mean, she's, what, 16 years old, and, you know, she can't participate officially, I guess, in, you know, elections or any kind of decision-making process, but she was just named Time's Person of the Year, right? She's having a global impact. And, you know, kids are really going to be the sort of motivation for a lot of communities to take charge of this, because if kids are raising their voices up, then that's a powerful thing.
And I want to add something real quick too. So I'm a big fan of Catherine Hayhoe. She's a very prominent climate scientist and climate communicator. And if you're looking for resources for children, she has a YouTube series called Global Weirding. It's all about climate change and specifically targeted to children. So I would recommend you look at that and encourage your students to look as well.
Thank you. We have one more call on the line. Tom calling from the West Side. Good morning, Tom. You're on First Coast Connect.
Ah, good morning to you all, too. My question is this. I've heard some talk about saltwater intrusion into our aquifer, and I'm wondering if that is secure or can be secured against sea level rise and climate change.
Right. Tom, that is definitely an issue with climate change, and as the sea rises and intrudes into the Florida aquifer where our groundwater, our drinking water comes from. Adam, what can be done about that?
So what I know from South Florida, I used to live in Miami, and it's a much bigger problem down there when it comes to saltwater intrusion into the aquifer. There's a city down there, Hollandale Beach, that actually had to, this was a number of years ago even, they had to move, they'd shut down a number of their wells for the city where they bring drinking water out and bring it to people's homes. They had to shut down their wells and actually drill more wells further away from the ocean to try to, you know, maintain a viable water supply. And as far as I know, that's the only way to deal with saltwater intrusion at this point. There's no way, you know, we live in a Swiss cheese state, right? I mean, the ground that we live on is limestone, and, mm-hmm. you know, water just sloshes back and forth, basically. I don't think there's any, you know, sort of engineering way to keep saltwater out. So what communities are doing, at least in South Florida, and it's, you know, starting to move up the coast as well, is just move their wells inland, which is obviously just a short-term solution, right? Because mm-hmm. if we don't do anything about sea level rise, and also on the other side, taking too much water out of the aquifer, right, and wasting our freshwater supplies, as a lot of Florida communities do currently, then that's just pushing off the inevitable of, you know, the aquifer being continued to be contaminated.
Challenges upon challenges with these issues. And what I like about the ADAPT podcast and the whole ADAPT project, though, is we also look at solutions. And we'll hear about some of those from all six of the people that we meet in this series. Brendan, very quickly, we're almost out of time, but can you tell us about a couple of the other folks we'll meet in the ADAPT podcast?
Yeah, sure. So we already spoke about Julia Neshawat, the state's first chief resilience officer. So we'll hear from her. We also hear from Richard Leon. He's Jacksonville's urban forestry manager. And he talks about all the benefits that trees provide in this program that he started recently called the 630 City Tree Planting Program. And basically you can call 630 City and ask for a tree and they'll come plant one or two trees in your yard, no cost to you. We'll also meet Shane Corbin. He's the city manager of Atlantic Beach, which recently got LEED certified as a city. And they also recently conducted a vulnerability assessment. So we talk about the process and the findings from those two endeavors. And then we also hear from Sean LaHave. He is a 24-year-old, and he is leading resilience efforts across Northeast Florida. Very impressive young man. He works for the Northeast Florida Regional Council. And he just kind of talks about the importance of working together on these issues and how in Northeast Florida, the business community is kind of needs to be the starting point for this conversation to really push for action. Mm-hmm. So those are the six people we're going to hear from, including Adam and Lauren here. So it's a project I'm really excited about. I hope you guys enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed working on it.
I think everybody should be excited to listen to it. Brendan, you've done a great job. The podcast sounds great. It's a little bit different from hearing Brendan on the radio here daily on 89.9 in a little bit different role. He had production help from WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride, and there's some cool funky music in there, and it's just some really good storytelling.
You helped a little bit.
Helped a little bit too. I may have edited them. But that is Brendan Rivers, WJCT's lead reporter and the host of the new Adapt podcast. Lauren Watkins, Adam Rosenblatt, and Jim Bruggers, the Adapt podcast and the written Q&As with the six people thinking about and working on solutions to climate change on the local level, along with gorgeous photos of them, I might add. That's all at adaptflorida.org. And while you're there, sign up to receive updates on when we'll publish the next full edition of Adapt or when we'll hold the next Adapt Public Summit here at WJCT. Both of those are scheduled for late spring of this year. Up next, a success story in finance. We'll hear from the CEO of Vistar Credit Union in today's First Coast Success, back in a moment.
First Coast Success is brought to you by Iberia Bank.
Welcome back. He's been tapped to lead one of the largest financial institutions in Northeast Florida. In today's First Coast Success, Jacksonville Daily Record editor Karen Bruni Mathis sits down with Brian Wolfberg, CEO of Vistar Credit Union.
Brian Wolfberg was named president and CEO of Vistar Credit Union in October 2017. Since then, the Jacksonville-based financial institution bought downtown property, including an office tower, to create a campus for 1,000 employees. It sponsors the Vistar Veterans Memorial Arena, and it has grown to $9.2 billion in assets and is the largest credit union based in Northeast Florida and the 15th largest in the country. Brian Wolfberg, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you, Karen. I'm happy to be here.
You've made strides in rather quickly elevating the profile and the reach of Vistar Credit Union, which was founded almost 70 years ago in Jacksonville. Was that your strategy upon taking the job?
Well, I think first and foremost, I wanted to come in and make sure that I continued our commitment to our legacy and to our city. There was a lot of great things going on at Vistar, and I wanted to make sure that those continued to occur. At the same time, there was a lot of improvements that could be made both internally and externally to the organization. And as we looked at the face of financial services and the industry as a whole going forward, and the fact that we'd soon be going over $10 billion and that there's added implications to that, we also knew that we had some change to make. So as I looked at taking the job, I wanted to make sure that I paid honor to our history, but also to invest in the organization and prepare it for the future. We've worked hard to change a lot of our systems internally in our infrastructure, as well as to elevate the brand and then to start to extend it out from the Northeast region.
Well, you've made a high profile in Jacksonville. And so where does Vistar fit within the city's major companies? And that includes your role in the leadership ranks of the city.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I look at the city as a whole, and there's a lot of amazing organizations that are here in Jacksonville, both headquartered here and with outpost offices here. And many of them are very much engaged in the city. That said, we are a Jacksonville organization that started on base close to 70 years ago, as you mentioned. And thus, I think it's important, especially as we've grown in size, for us to be at the forefront of that. I think that we want to be a leader both in projecting economic viability of the region, projecting a new sort of technologically advanced and innovative region. And also we've worked hard to push a diverse and inclusive environment. It's important to us as the economy changes that all of the individuals in the region partake in that advancement.
I have a coworker who has talked about going to the ViStar branch with his dad on the Navy base, and he talked about just how much of a change the organization has made since then.
Yeah, we, as you said, we started close to 70 years ago, and it was started by 12 individuals with just $60. And before there was even a branch location, they were operating. And then the first branch location, which we have pictures of, was a little house on base. Since that time, we've moved a few times. The organization has obviously grown. And in fact, that branch is currently under renovations. And it's going to become one of our newer branches with a lot of technology in it, as well as an attached Starbucks. And so a lot has changed for us organizationally, as well as for that location. But the one thing that has not changed is our commitment to the military and to veterans in the region. And so I'm really happy that we're still able to maintain that branch and to commit to that level of product service and member service.
And what was its name at the beginning?
So we were Jack's Navy Federal Credit Union, and about 20 years ago in around 2000, we went through some changes to our field of membership, which were facilitated by a change in our chartering. And at that time, we did a reevaluation of our name and rebranded as ViStar.
And anybody going through downtown Jacksonville will see that name and will see the logo both on your tower downtown and over on the Veterans Memorial Arena. Well, you moved to Jacksonville from Alaska. It's a little cold today, but probably doesn't compare. And you were chief operations officer at the Alaska USA Federal Credit Union, and that was in Anchorage, and that was $7 billion in assets. You've worked globally. You grew up in Buffalo. How did you choose a career in financial services that brought you to Jacksonville?
I would say that I was always interested in business. Way back to when I was a young child, I used to always be very entrepreneurial. I used to run yard service businesses for my neighbors. I produced a local newspaper that I sold in the community. I used to have a candy business. I had a lemonade stand that I sort of franchised and had multiple locations around our town and did advertising for. So for me, business always came natural. As I moved up through high school and into college, I did study business. I was a finance, marketing, and international business undergrad, and then did a master's in business. Coming out of school, I started to work in investment services. I used to work for some of the larger national and international firms, and as you mentioned, that was a part of what took me overseas. Early in my career, I got into a management development program with HSBC. It took me over to Europe and to Asia for bits of my career. But it also really excited me about working in a variety of different areas of the business. And so that's what has led to my trajectory up through management, because I do enjoy the variety throughout the day of all the things that play into being a CEO.
Can you say what your plan is maybe for the immediate future for ViStar?
Yeah, I think for ViStar, we're looking to ensure that we continue to do what we have done. That has been well received by the community for the last 67 years, and staying true to that, staying true to our roots and our commitment to the military and the veterans, second to the region as a whole. But then after that, we are looking to expand out and to grow the credit union. We have recently moved from the top 20 credit unions to the top 15 credit unions and are on a trajectory to probably be in the top 10 credit unions in the country out of 5,000 plus in the next year or two. We are doing that for reasons of the performance of the organization and the safety and soundness, but that would likely leave us as one of the largest financial institutions that is state chartered or headquartered in the state. Part of that is going to be serving the whole state.
Well, Brian Wolfberg, President and CEO of ViStar Credit Union, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you very much, Karen.
The This is First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo in for Melissa Ross. Well, January is almost over, but there are plenty of places around town where you can stay dry year-round. The Up Bar pop-up at the Hotel Palms in Atlantic Beach is one of them, and its owner, Jamie Rice, is hosting a mocktail social this evening, along with Gina Palillo, who owns the Glass Bottle Society in Five Points. They are both here with me now. Good morning, Jamie and Gina.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. So, Jamie, first of all, what is the Up Bar?
The Up Bar is an evening affair at the Hotel Palms. It's just an extension of the coffee service that you may know on the weekends. It's just serving the uppers to all those curious to come through. You've got coffee and you've got some non-alcoholic beverages to choose from.
And why non-alcoholic beverages? What is the idea here with the Up Bar?
Honestly, it was just a small challenge to myself is how it started. It was always a curious offering on some menus that ended up tasting like, you know, a fizzy pink nerd. And I thought it could be done a little bit better. So just did a little digging on the internet and got inspired by some stuff. And now I offer it on my own bar.
All right. So Up Bar is a pop-up, and how often does that pop up?
A couple times a month. Definitely 2020, I'd look to see the Up Bar a little bit more than a couple times a month, but for now it's towards the end of every month, definitely the last Friday at Hotel Palms, just trying to grow its own scene.
Okay, and have you seen the scene growing since you started doing it?
Yeah, just like Show Pigeon's coffee program inside of the Hotel Palms lobby, it definitely took a little bit of time to gain some traction. But it's not been too long that I've been doing the Up Bar, and there is a slow increase that's happening of people coming through, mm-hmm. people that are curious, people that are friends, people that are just staying at the hotel. So it's a good stop in the middle of your evening.
Yeah. So Gina, how did you get involved in what's going to be happening tonight?
So I own a business where I sell barware supplies in Five Points, and Jamie came to me and said, let's put on this event. And we just worked together to make it happen and support this positive scene.
So you're bringing the expertise as far as how to put on a good cocktail event.
I hope so.
And what can people expect at this mocktail social?
We're just looking to bring people in to get outside of their comfort zone. I mean, the hotel still has beer and wine if you're looking to tie one on, but it's just to have conversations over conscious drinks. That's all.
What is a conscious drink?
One that you sip and savor, and not one you slam.
Mm. So you're conscious of
the whole experience, the flavor profile, how it looks, the aesthetics, and how it hits your nose, and then how it sits on your palate, how it lingers. It's all about the multi-experience of a beverage. It's what I enjoy when I do step out for a proper cocktail. I want to have all those things.
Now, we've heard about Dry January for years now, people trying to kind of have a reset at the beginning of the year, start off healthy, abstain just temporarily, and then maybe get back into it. It seems like this kind of sober curious, and I don't know if you like that label, sober curious, but this movement does seem to be growing nationwide. And like, we had the opening of Wildcrafters in Five Points recently, which is a non-alcoholic bar.
Love them.
And it just seems like this is becoming more and more popular. Is that something, Gina, do you see that being in Five Points? Is that something that's growing?
I do think it's something that is growing. And I always try to, you know, show people that if they come in my store, a lot of people think, oh, I don't drink alcohol, these things aren't for me.
Right.
And I don't think that's true at all. I think making beverages is a craft, and I think it's about enjoyment. And I think the more we educate ourselves about it, the more we can enjoy those experiences.
What is the experience exactly that we're going to have tonight if we come to the Hotel Palms?
I think partially what Jamie said about enjoying your drinks. And I think also it's about bringing people together and enjoying the people that you're with.
Is there a competition aspect to it?
Yeah, there's definitely a, it's called a social because there is no like judges panel. There's no presentation as far as, you know, this glassware and then I slapped that and here we are. It's nothing to do with that. It's a crowd-based competition. It's seven competitors that'll be standing at one table, serving up little sample sizes of their creations. Most of these folks are from a coffee background. I think you got three coffee background, two regular folk, one from Wildcrafters, and one that's at Gina's store, okay, who's just a home enthusiast. So it's by no means for just the professional bartender. That was not the goal. That's why it's social in the name. It's not a competition. So it's just for folks to cruise through, check it out. You got the up bar in full swing. You'll have some DJs bumping some music. You've got Gina's friend that's going to offer up Aura Jacks. She's going to have some nice seating and set up for you to sit and take your Instagram pictures. So yeah, I mean, it should just be a nice affair. That's all. It's a Monday night. It's 6 to 9, it's easy going, and it's sociable. That's the whole point, just to have something a little bit different and stay up a little bit later and still wake up early.
Do you need a ticket to come to the event?
No ticket, no need. Just come through. We hope to tally the vote by 8, so if you want to make it before then, that'd be great. But yeah, no ticket, it's an open gate.
Do you think that conscious drinking will continue throughout the rest of the year after January?
Oh, you know, people will settle back into their ways, but even if it doesn't last all year, I still think it'd be cool to have a place at the bar to have that nice, thoughtful beverage where 2 ounces is made up of something that's not liquor. We all want to still hang out with our friends and our favorite dive with maybe a cigarette, but, you know, it's not always about getting wasted.
And do you think that this kind of event will happen again at the Up Bar at the Hotel Palms? Is this maybe the first of many?
Maybe. Who knows? It's my first go at it.
Yeah.
I needed Gina's help because she's from the bar world. I've got no idea. I'm coffee world. So yeah, that's why we're collaborating on this. It'd be cool to push it. We were talking in the lobby to some other spaces, whether it be Wildcrafters or a well-known bar in town, but this is the first of many, sure. At Hotel Palms, not sure.
Have you gotten a sample or a preview of what these beverages are going to be tonight? Any idea?
The competitors did submit some of their recipes, but have I tried them? No. Mm-mm.
What kind of ingredients are in these?
So the game is coffee-based for sure. Bold Bean was donating the coffee base for all the competitors. And the rest is up to them.
So you start with some Bold Bean coffee and then
whatever. Yeah, you can use a different base, whether it be a nitro coffee, it's cold brew, it's a little bit more punch, and then you got flash brew iced coffee. That's what I use typically on the Up Bar service and weekend service for Show Pigeon. You can just buy a bag of beans and brew it up how you want to. It's up to the competitors.
This sounds like something that would really appeal to foodies, like just people who want to taste different things.
Yeah, we'll see who cruises through.
Yeah. So again, the event is tonight. It's the Mocktail Social, right?
Correct.
And that is Jamie Rice, who is with Up Bar at the Hotel Palms, hosting that Mocktail Social, along with Gina Palillo, who owns the Glass Bottle Society in Five Points. And that is from 6 to 9 tonight at the Hotel Palms. Up next, Cole Pepper will join us with a look at how the sports world is mourning the death of basketball legend Kobe Bryant.
Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good. Jacksonville Country Day School. Through intellectual exploration involving project-based and transformative learning, JCDS prepares pre-K 3 through 6th grade students for success at the next academic level and beyond. More at jcds.com. Open house on February 4th, 9:30 a.m.
White House lawyers began their opening arguments with an overview of their defense.
They're asking you to remove President Trump from the ballot in an election that's occurring in approximately 9 months.
The case against removing the president from office is underway. Join us for live special coverage of the sixth day of the Senate impeachment trial from NPR News.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, how our military leaders think about the unthinkable. Journalist Fred Kaplan says President Trump's threat to rain fire and fury on North Korea has made many Americans consider the prospect of nuclear war for the first time in decades. His new book explores how our leaders have planned for and sometimes narrowly avoided nuclear conflict. It's called The Bomb. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
A new novel unleashes a firestorm about who gets to write about the migrant Latino experience and the realities in Mexico. The author of American Dirt bagged a seven-figure deal for her book. She identifies as white with Latina heritage. I'm Todd Zwillick. Who gets to tell these stories? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Welcome back. The sports world is mourning the death of former basketball star Kobe Bryant, who died in a helicopter crash yesterday along with his daughter. Culpepper is here now with more. Hi, Cole.
Hi, Jessica. Yeah, this was a bombshell that really rocked the sports world and beyond yesterday. Bryant, his 13-year-old daughter, and seven others were flying in a helicopter en route to a basketball camp where Bryant was going to be coaching his daughter Gianna, known as Gigi. Then the copter went down in Calabasas, California. There were no survivors. Reaction came from former teammates and opponents, from athletes in other sports. At the Pro Bowl, Calais Campbell dropped to a knee to pray as they showed a photo of Bryant on the video board. Both Presidents Trump and Obama tweeted out condolences. Soccer stars in Europe paid their respects on social media. At several NBA games, teams used their first possession to allow the 24-second clock to expire in honor of Bryant, who wore both 24 and 8 during his time with the Lakers. Both numbers were illuminated in the rafters of the Staples Center last night, where the Lakers play their home games and where the Grammys were held. Alicia Keys, hosting the Grammys, noted Bryant's death and was joined on stage by Boyz II Men to sing "It's So Hard to Say Goodbye" in what was certainly the most touching moment of that award ceremony. Bryant will be remembered as one of the most determined players in NBA history and one of the best. He was just passed on Saturday by LeBron James for third on the league's all-time scoring list. He was also more worldly than most NBA players, having spent 7 years of his youth in Italy. He was fluent in Italian. His father was a basketball player, a former NBA player, and also played in Europe. That's why Bryant spent time in Italy, as his father was playing in the European leagues. Mm-hmm. He also won an Oscar for an animated short based on a poem he wrote after his retirement called Dear Basketball. All this for a guy who is just 41 years old. And I think Doc Rivers, the NBA coach, who knew Bryant very well, summed it up best, saying he felt like Kobe had so much more to give the world, not the least of which being what he could have given his four daughters, now the three remaining. This is one of those deaths in the sports world that reverberates across all sports and beyond. As we mentioned, the Grammys,
right?
Outside of the Staples Center, they were setting up these makeshift memorials. They turned the colors both at LAX and at the Staples Center to the Lakers gold and purple. Kobe Bryant was a massive star in the NBA. He was sort of the bridge player between Michael Jordan and LeBron James, gone at the age of 41.
And you mentioned beyond at the Pro Bowl, the prayer for Kobe Bryant there and the Jaguars at the Pro Bowl, Cole.
Yeah, they had some very good performances from the three Jaguars who were there. All three contributed to the win for the AFC. DJ Chark caught a touchdown pass. Josh Allen blocked a point after and recorded a sack. And Calais Campbell had a sack and a forced fumble, earning him defensive MVP honors as the AFC beat the NFC. Allen said the first the thing that really got him going was a halftime speech by Hall of Fame defensive end Bruce Smith, late of the Buffalo Bills. Really motivated him for the second half. Smith told Allen and the rest of the AFC in the halftime locker room, what do you want them to be talking about when they talk about the 2020 Pro Bowl? And this is the Pro Bowl, Jessica, is not exactly a rock'em sock'em affair. It has gotten less physical and less physical over time as players' salaries have gone up, and the realization that is if you get hurt in the Pro Bowl, it affects everything else.
Right.
So the tackling, and I put that in strong air quotes, can often be a little patty cake or a firm hug or maybe just a redirection to there's the sideline, just run out to the sideline. But we saw some players really get going in the second half after that speech, and Allen and Calais Campbell were among them on the defensive side of the football for the AFC. Great experience for Allen, who was the first rookie in Jaguars history to play in a Pro Bowl, and for DJ Chark, who's just the fourth wide receiver in Jaguars history to play in a Pro Bowl. Of course, Calais Campbell's an old hat at this. That was his fifth Pro Bowl, but the first time to win the defensive MVP honors.
And an actual real football game is coming up this Sunday.
Yes, there will be real tackling and actual football. We call it the Super Bowl, Jessica, and it's the Kansas City Chiefs against the San Francisco 49ers. One of the intriguing parts of this matchup is that these are the two fastest offenses. Now with these next generation stats, the NFL can follow the speed of every player, and the skill position players for both teams are the two fastest in the NFL. Of course, the 49ers have had great success with Joe Montana and Steve Young in the past in the Super Bowl. The Chiefs have not been to the Super Bowl in 50 years. Mm. I grew up in Kansas City hearing stories of Len Dawson and company. I have never seen the Chiefs in the Super Bowl. I'm not old enough to have seen that. I'm 4 years shy of that. So there's a lot of excitement. I'm going to go ahead and make my pick right now, Jessica. And, of course, as you might expect, I'm going with the Chiefs to win the Super Bowl in a high-scoring, close affair. Give me the Chiefs 31-29.
All right. You heard it here, everyone. Thanks, Cole. Cole Pepper, WJCT sports analyst here every Monday.
Thanks, Jessica.
That's our program. Thank you to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director on the board. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send us an email, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. First Coast Connect is every weekday morning at 9 and 8 on weekday evenings here on 89.9, or listen to all the episodes at wjct.org. I'm Jessica Palumbo. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Melissa Ross will be back at 9 tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.